Welcome to The Deep Dive, the only show that really digs into a mountain of groundbreaking scientific research and pulls out the most important, the most mind-blowing insights just for you. I'm Alex Sagan, your guide to what's new, and this deep dive is all about the latest findings from New Scientist magazine for the week of October 4th, 2025.
And I'm Sam Fleming. I'm here to help, you know, connect the dots, explain not just what these breakthroughs are, but really why they matter for how we understand reality, our lifespan, even policy.
Yeah. And our mission today is, well, it's pretty exhaustive. We're going from the very edges of particle physics, looking at the secrets of our galaxy's own supermassive black hole.
All the way down to human genetics, ancient human evolution, and of course, the climate crisis.
We are going deep. And we have to start, actually, on a bit of a contentious note. The very real cost of health misinformation and policy decisions that seem to be racing ahead of the science.
That's absolutely right. We've got two stories here involving U.S. policy, both centered on autism spectrum disorder, or ASD. And they both really highlight the dangers when politics and, let's say, preliminary science get mixed up. It just risks confusing the public.
Okay, let's jump right in. The first one is this public advice from U.S. President Donald Trump, warning against using paracetamol, that's acetaminophen, during pregnancy,
yeah,
linking it to autism risk. And this, well, it caused an immediate uproar.
Yeah, and for very good reason. I mean, this is almost a textbook example of confusing correlation with causation. For years, maybe decades, some studies, observational ones, suggested a link, an association between paracetamol use in pregnancy and maybe slightly higher rates of things like ADHD or ASD.
But an association isn't proof it causes it, right?
Exactly. Correlation is not causation. And the sources highlight a really critical, very recent piece of research that, frankly, should probably put this debate to rest, at least for now.
Okay, tell us about that one.
It's a major study. We're talking millions of children. Mm. And they used a much, much more robust method than just looking at correlations. They specifically compared siblings, where one sibling was exposed to paracetamol in the womb and the other wasn't. And when they controlled for that crucial factor, the shared family history, the genetics, guess what?
The link disappeared.
Completely vanished. It strongly suggests that the shared genetic background, you know, the family predisposition, that's the key factor increasing the risk, not the medication itself.
Which is huge because paracetamol is used for common things like pain and fever during pregnancy.
Exactly. And high fevers are actually dangerous for the fetus. So this is critical because, as the analysis points out, the alternative is just catastrophic confusion. Pregnant women are already flooded with better safe than sorry advice. You know, sometimes it borders on a missed diet, sleep, chemicals.
Yeah.
Adding a high profile, unfounded warning against one of the safest pain meds available, especially one needed for fever, it's just profoundly risky.
The magazine drew a really sharp historical parallel here that really hit home for me.
They did. They referenced that debunked study linking the MMR vaccine to autism. Remember that?
Of course.
That initial bad advice, given so much weight decades ago, it still echoes today. That misinformation is directly tied, they argue, to the recent resurgence of preventable diseases. They cited 40 measles outbreaks in the U.S. just this year.
Wow.
It's a really sobering reminder. Publicly prominent, unfounded health advice can cause real, measurable harm long after it's been scientifically shot down.
And if that wasn't enough, there's this second initiative from the U.S. government. It's kind of the flip side, fast-tracking a treatment. The approval of leucovorin for some children with ASD.
Right. So this is the opposite approach intervention, not avoidance. But it faces actually the same scientific challenge. The evidence isn't quite there yet. Leucovorin is a form of vitamin B9. It's used to treat a rare metabolic condition called cerebral folate deficiency. And the sources note this deficiency might affect up to 40% of autistic individuals. Treating the deficiency itself can definitely help with associated symptoms. That's clear.
But the fast-track approval is for treating ASD specifically, not just the deficiency. That's where it gets thin.
That's exactly where the science is described as, quote, tentative. We're talking small pilot studies, maybe some modest improvements in a few patients, but nothing that really meets the usual standard for a big policy-backed approval like this.
And there's a bigger trial underway.
Yes, a larger definitive clinical trial is happening, but those results, they won't be ready until next year. So the concern is, by fast-tracking it now, the government is sort of implying this is a proven solution to what they're calling a crisis of autism when the evidence just hasn't caught up.
That political framing calling ASD an epidemic or a sudden crisis, that's interesting in itself. Why do you think this policy push is happening right now, especially when we know a lot of the rate increase is linked to better diagnosis and awareness?
It really seems like a response to public anxiety, doesn't it? By offering both a high-profile warning, the paracetamol thing, and a fast-track solution, the Lucavorant, the political message seems to be, look, we're taking historic steps to confront this crisis.
But the science doesn't back that level of intervention on either front?
Not robustly, no. And the potential downside is real. Confusing parents about safe pregnancy care on one hand, and maybe raising false hopes about a treatment based on very preliminary findings on the other.
It just hammers home how vital it is for robust foundational research to guide policy, not the other way around. Let's follow that thread of foundational research then. We'll pivot now from immediate health policy to the real extremes of physics and computation.
Okay.
We're moving from molecules in a cell to maybe exotic particles that could make up, 85% of all the matter in the universe?
We're diving into the hunt for dark matter. Specifically, the top candidate, theoretically speaking, the axion. But what's really clever in this article is the idea that evidence of something like axions, axion-like particles, or ALPs, might actually be hiding in old data. Years-old data from the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider.
That's brilliant, like scientific recycling. We usually think of the LHC smashing things together and looking at the debris. How are they suggesting finding new particles before the crash?
It's about radiation and acceleration. The theory goes like this. As high-energy protons and ions are accelerated in that huge ring, getting close to the speed of light, they start radiating photons light.
Right.
The model suggests they could also be radiating these incredibly light, weakly interacting particles, the ALPs. So the search strategy is to look for collisions between those radiated ALPs and photons right there in the data sets they already have.
So not sifting the debris after the main collision, but looking for a subtle interaction just before it happens in the energy field.
Exactly. The researchers modeled this effect, and they pinpointed a specific data set from 2016 where protons smashed into lead ions as the most promising place to look. The energy environment was just right.
And finding this wouldn't necessarily be the axion.
No, not the classical axion, probably. But finding ALPs would confirm a much richer picture of particle physics, a whole new family of weakly interacting particles that would, really shake up our understanding of the Standard Model and suggest totally new ideas about what dark matter could be made of.
Using old data for brand new physics. Love it.
Mm.
Meanwhile, on the quantum front, the big challenge is always scaling up, getting enough qubits, the quantum bits, to work reliably. And Caltech researchers just blew the record out of the water using neutral atoms.
Oh, it's a huge leap, a really dramatic scaling jump. They've built a new device with 6,100 neutral cesium atoms all acting as individual qubits.
6,100. What was the old record?
Just 11,080. So it's a massive increase. The neutral atom approach, trapping individual atoms with lasers, it's really showing its strength against other quantum computing methods like superconducting circuits.
The engineering must be mind-boggling. You've got 6,100 individual atoms.
Right.
Cool to almost absolute zero, held perfectly still in a grid by lasers. Uh-huh. Where was the big breakthrough that let them scale up so much?
It seems to lie in the finesse of the control. They really mastered tuning those lasers to keep the atoms in their fragile quantum states superposition, entanglement, while keeping the whole array incredibly stable for longer periods.
And stability is key for accuracy.
It's everything. Quantum computations need time to run accurately, so you need that stability, that combination extreme cold microscopic laser control that seems to be the secret sauce here.
And the ambition, it's just staggering. They're not stopping at 6,100, are they?
Not at all. The Caltech team's stated goal, get this, scale this neutral atom machine up to 1 million qubits within a decade. That timeline just shows you the speed, the intensity of the global quantum computing race. If they pull that off, many of the hurdles we face now in computation would just evaporate overnight.
Speaking of things that warp reality, let's talk about time itself, the world's absolute best clocks. These are made from thousands of ions cooled way, way down. They're now being used to test how quantum physics might actually change the passage of time. This is Einstein meets quantum.
Exactly. We know from relativity, right? Time dilates. It stretches if you move really fast or if you're in a strong gravitational field. The big question now is, what happens to time for an object that's governed by quantum rules?
And the researchers are looking at two specific quantum effects that could stretch time, even near absolute zero. Let's start with the most fundamental quantum idea.
Okay, the first effect comes from this basic principle. Quantum physics hates nothingness. Even these super chilled ions can never be perfectly still. They have to fluctuate constantly, randomly gaining or losing tiny bits of energy.
The uncertainty principle.
Right. And the calculations suggest these unavoidable quantum jitters could cause a tiny, but maybe just observable, dilation, a slight stretching in the time measured by this ion clock.
So the inherent fuzziness of reality might actually affect time flow. Wow. Okay, what's the second effect? It involves superposition and entanglement. Sounds even weirder.
It is genuinely mind-bending. They modeled ions that are put into a squeezed state. That means they're in a superposition of multiple quantum states at once, like being in two places or energy levels simultaneously.
Okay.
And they found something amazing. The clock's ticking, its measurement of time, would become fundamentally linked, entangled with the ion's own motion or state.
Let me try to get my head around that. So a normal clock just measures time passing for an object.
Yeah.
But here, the quantum object existing in that superposition actually affects its own experience of time.
That's the core idea. The implication is wild. A quantum object in superposition might not experience a single clear sense of time. The clock's measurement gets mathematically tangled up with the ion's probabilistic state. Now, they haven't actually seen this yet.
But the clocks are good enough now to potentially test it.
They believe so. The current generation of ultra-cold ion clocks might be precise enough to detect this effect within the next few years.
And this really touches on a massive point, something we saw hinted at in the source material elsewhere. Remember that study on the C. elegans worm's connectome?
Oh, yeah, mapping every single neuron connection.
Right. And they realized just knowing the map, the structure, doesn't actually tell you how the system works, how it processes information. It's the dynamic flow that's missing.
That's a perfect parallel. Just like knowing the street map doesn't tell you about traffic flow, knowing the structure of, say, quantum gravity or a brain doesn't tell us how time or consciousness actually flows. These ultra-cold clock experiments are forcing us to confront that dynamic process at the most fundamental level imaginable.
Okay, let's shift scales again. From microscopic quantum weirdness to the truly massive. Let's look at the cosmos, starting right in our own galactic backyard. Sagittarius A, our supermassive black hole.
Right.
We finally have solid proof of something astronomers have suspected since the 70s.
Yes. The first really conclusive detection of hot wind blasting out from SGRA. You know, SGRA has always been a bit weird because it's so quiet compared to black holes and other galaxies.
The ones that shoot out those huge jets, the quasars.
Exactly, those cosmic lighthouses. Ours is basically dormant, but theory always said it must still be pushing out some kind of wind, a sort of steady outflow of hot gas.
But finding it is tough because the area around SGRA is just so messy, right? All that cold gas and dust swirling around.
Incredibly messy. That circumnuclear disk makes seeing a faint, diffuse wind almost impossible. So how did they finally spot it?
They used data from ALMA, the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, collected over 5 years. And the trick was, well, it was revolutionary. They had to filter out the noise. SGRA itself flickers really brightly.
So they had to subtract the flicker.
Precisely. They made super detailed simulations of that flicker and subtracted it from the data. What was left was a map of the surrounding cold gas that was 100 times sharper than ever before.
And what did that super sharp map show? A clear cone shape. A gap where cold gas should have been, but wasn't. And when they overlaid X-ray data, which only shows hot gas, the two maps lined up perfectly. The missing cold gas had been blown away, replaced by a stream of hot plasma. The wind.
And you mentioned the energy involved is important, equivalent to 25,000 suns. Why does that specific number matter?
That measurement gives us crucial constraints. That much energy is basically the minimum needed to overcome the black hole's gravity and push the gas outwards. It confirms the wind must be coming from just GRA. And it helps answer that big mystery. Why is our black hole so quiet?
Because the wind is blowing away the fuel.
Exactly. It's constantly carrying matter away, limiting how much can fall in and trigger one of those massive quasar outbursts.
And this could also help figure out how SGRA is spinning.
Potentially, yes. The shape of the wind, that cone structure, gives new clues that the first Event Horizon telescope image couldn't quite resolve. A black hole spin tells you about its history, and measuring the wind's speed and direction gives us data to constrain SGRA's rotation rate and axis.
This whole discussion about structure versus function leads us straight to the deeper question.
Mm-hmm.
Is SGRA really what general relativity says it is? Or could it be some kind of imposter?
Ah, the singularity problem. It's the elephant in the room for physics. General relativity demands this point of infinite density at the center, but most physicists think that can't be real. It signals that our current laws break down, so you get alternatives. Regular black holes, maybe with some quantum effects stopping the collapse, or mimickers.
Mimickers. What are the main candidates for those?
They look like black holes from a distance, but they lack the key feature, the event horizon, the point of no return. Instead, they have some kind of surface. The two big ideas are gravistars, basically bubbles of weird repulsive energy with a super dense shell, and fuzzballs. These come from string theory, suggesting the horizon is replaced by a sort of quantum fuzz made of strings. In either case, the key difference is the surface. Mimickers have one, true black holes don't.
And how are we using things like the Event Horizon Telescope and LIGO, the gravitational wave detector, to tell the difference?
It's incredibly subtle work. The EHT is looking for tiny deviations in the size or shape of the black hole's shadow. And crucially, they're trying to resolve the photon ring. That's a thin ring of light that orbits the black hole multiple times before escaping.
Right.
A mimicker, because it has a surface, should slightly alter how that photon ring looks compared to the exact predictions of general relativity.
Which is why they want the Black Hole Explorer, BHEX, to get a much sharper view.
Exactly. BHEX, if it gets funded, would put telescopes thousands of kilometers out in space, extending the EHT's baseline dramatically. That would give enough resolution to clearly separate the light from the infalling gas from the light of the photon ring itself, a much cleaner test.
And the other way is looking for echoes in gravitational waves when these things merge.
Yes. When two true black holes merge, you get a gravitational wave signal, a chirp that quickly fades. If two mimickers merge, the idea is the wave should bounce off their surfaces, creating faint echoes after the main signal.
Have they seen any echoes?
There was one tentative hint years ago, but follow-up searches haven't found anything conclusive. We might need more mergers, or maybe better theoretical models of exactly what those echoes should sound like.
Okay, let's stay in the solar system but come closer to home. We've now got direct evidence for huge underground lava tubes on Venus. We suspected they were there from pits on the surface, but this confirms it. But there's something weird about their size.
Totally weird. It messes up the trend we see everywhere else. Like on the moon, lava tubes are enormous because the gravity is low, right? The roof can span a huge distance before collapsing.
Makes sense.
Venus has gravity like Earth's, so you'd expect Earth-sized tubes. But nope. These tubes are surprisingly wide. Their volume is comparable to the giant ones on the moon.
So why are they so wide if the gravity should make them smaller?
The researchers think it's Venus's crazy environment. The extreme heat, hotter than your oven, combined with the crushing atmospheric pressure, probably causes an overall flattening out of the tubes, as they put it. This unique environment just overrides the normal gravity effect, creating these wide, maybe shallower structures.
Fascinating. Okay, let's wrap up our space tour with a literal blast from the past. Evidence that a star might have exploded pretty close to Earth about 10 million years ago.
Yeah, this hinges on an amazing find 5 kilometers down beneath the Pacific Ocean. A spike in radioactive beryllium, beryllium-10, dated precisely to 10 million years ago.
And beryllium-10 only comes from cosmic rays hitting our atmosphere.
Exactly. It's a telltale sign of a powerful burst of cosmic rays hitting Earth at that specific time. So the question was, where did they come from?
How did they track down the exploding star?
They used data from the Gaia Space Telescope. Gaia is mapping the movement of stars and clusters with incredible precision. By tracing the orbits of star clusters backwards 10 million years, they found a high probability, like 70%, that a young star cluster was within about 300 light years of Earth, right at the time of that beryllium spike.
300 light years? That's cosmically close for a supernova.
It really is. They even narrowed it down to 2 likely source clusters, one called ASCC-20, maybe only 200 light years away then, and another called OCSN-61, a bit further out. And this lines up beautifully with other evidence, a different spike, this time in radioactive iron-60 dust, found from about 7.5 million years ago.
So the cosmic rays arrive first, then the dust cloud later.
That's the theory. The cosmic rays travel at nearly the speed of light, so they hit Earth 10 million years ago. The slower moving dust and debris from the explosion arrived a couple of million years later. It paints a pretty dramatic picture of our solar system's past environment.
Incredible. Okay, from cosmic history and stellar death, let's bring it right back down to Earth. To life, evolution, and the enduring mystery of aging. Starting with some really remarkable insights from studying the world's oldest known person, Maria Brañas Moreira, who lived to be 117.
Yeah, the detailed study of her genetics, her biology, her lifestyle, it's almost like a blueprint for exceptional longevity. First off, her genetics were, quote, exceptional. Her genome was packed with variations linked to longer lifespan in other animals like dogs and worms.
And just as important was what wasn't in her genome, right?
Absolutely. She was noticeably lacking the common genetic variants linked to age-related diseases, Alzheimer's, major cancers, metabolic problems. So it suggests a double whammy. Good genes for longevity and dodging the genetic bullets that cause common diseases.
And her body itself seemed to be aging slower internally, her biological clock.
Exactly. Her biological age, measured by looking at chemical tags on her DNA epigenetic clocks, was, on average, 23 years younger than her actual age of 117.
23 years younger.
Yeah, indicating her cells were functioning more like someone in their 90s. And her lipid metabolism, how she processed fats, was among the most efficient ever recorded. Likely a mix of genes and her frugal Mediterranean diet.
But the finding that really jumped out, maybe the most actionable one, was about her gut microbiome.
That was fascinating. They found she still had an incredibly efficient immune system. And crucially, her gut bacteria looked like that of a much, much younger person. Specifically, high levels of a group called Actinobacteriota, which includes the probiotic Bifidobacterium, those levels usually plummet as we age.
And a healthy microbiome is key for fighting inflammation and disease.
Hugely important. And the researchers pointed to a surprisingly simple lifestyle factor that might have helped maintain this youthful microbiome.
What was it?
It sounds almost too simple, but 3 servings of plain sugar-free yogurt every day. Alongside her Mediterranean diet and avoiding alcohol and smoking, this simple habit might have played a real role in keeping her gut microbes diverse and functional well past 100.
That's incredible. Yogurt. Okay, moving from external factors like diet to internal switches, researchers have pinpointed a protein complex called DREAM. It might be a master regulator of DNA repair and maybe aging itself.
Yeah, the DREAM complex, it stands for a bunch of protein names, dimerization partner, RB-like, E2F, and MUV-B. It acts like a master switch, controlling when cells divide and how they maintain their DNA. And the mechanism they found is, well, it's kind of alarming.
How does it work?
Basically, when DREAM activity is high, it actively switches off hundreds of genes involved in DNA repair.
It turns off the repair crew.
Exactly. So with the repair systems down, mutations build up over time. And that accumulation of DNA damage is one of the main theories of why we age.
And the evidence linking DREAM to aging seems pretty strong across different animals.
It's compelling. In mouse cells, high DREAM activity meant more mutations, but then they looked across 92 different mammal species, and they found this strong correlation. Species with naturally low DREAM activity tended to have longer maximum lifespans.
Wow. And did they manage to show it causes more mutations in mice?
They did. They engineered mice to completely lack DREAM activity from early life. And those mice, they had 20% fewer mutations in their brain cells compared to normal mice. That's a pretty direct causal link between this complex and the rate mutations pile up.
So the big idea is, if we could somehow dial down DREAM activity, find that sweet spot, the Goldilocks zone, maybe we could develop drugs to slow down that mutation accumulation and extend healthy lifespan.
That's the hope. But the researchers are careful. They stress we still need to prove it's a cause of normal aging, not just mutation buildup. It's promising, but early days for therapies.
Okay, from general aging to a specific devastating disease. There's been a huge, unprecedented breakthrough reported for Huntington's disease. An experimental gene therapy, AMT-130, has actually slowed the disease's progression for the first time ever.
This is genuinely massive news. Slowing progression by potentially 75%. Huntington's is this awful, fatal, inherited condition caused by a single gene mutation making a toxic protein that kills brain cells.
So how does AMT-130 fight back?
It's a really targeted gene therapy approach. They use a harmless virus to deliver special genetic material deep into the brain, right into the areas hit hardest by Huntington's, the caudate nucleus, and putamen. This material carries instructions to make something called microRNA.
And the microRNA is like a stop sign for the bad protein.
Exactly. These tiny microRNA molecules basically intercept the instructions coming from the mutated gene. They block the cell from making the toxic Huntington protein. By silencing those instructions, they drastically cut down the toxic protein production, giving the brain cells a chance to survive longer.
And the results from the trial sound incredible. 4 years worth of typical decline squeezed into just 1 year.
Yeah, that 75% slowdown represents potentially years of extra functional life for patients. It's a huge deal for them and their families.
And the potential goes beyond Huntington's.
That's what's really exciting. The basic approach, using a virus to deliver a targeted microRNA stop signal, could potentially be adapted. Just change the microRNA instructions to target different toxic proteins involved in other neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's.
So we might see applications for this soon.
They expect to apply to the FDA early next year for the Huntington's treatment. It's moving fast.
Amazing progress. We've talked about exceptional long-lived brains, brains under attack from disease. Let's look at baby brains now and their unique learning rhythm.
This is really neat. Researchers found that babies' background brain activity sort of ticks at a slower rhythm than adults. It's about 4 hertz, that's the theta rhythm, compared to the adult brain's baseline of around 10 hertz, the alpha rhythm.
Okay, so babies' brains tick slower. What's the significance of that 4 hertz theta rhythm being constantly active?
Well, in adult brains, that theta rhythm is specifically linked to higher-level thinking, particularly when we're forming new concepts or encoding new memories. The fact that it's just always on in the background for babies, no matter what they're doing, suggests they are basically operating in this perpetual, high-efficiency, constant learning mode.
Wow. Always ready to learn something new. Whereas the adult 10 hertz rhythm is more about.
The faster alpha rhythm in adults seems to help more with retrieving knowledge we already have and, importantly, filtering out irrelevant information. It's like the difference between constantly building a huge library from scratch versus efficiently finding a specific book in a well-organized, smaller library.
That's a great way to put it. The baby brain is optimized for novelty and structure, constantly wiring itself up, while the adult brain prioritizes efficiency and using what it knows.
Exactly. That constant 4 hertz signal seems to prime all the neural circuits involved in soaking up new knowledge.
That drive to learn, to build structure, links perfectly to our next section: deep history, evolution, and maybe rewriting the human story itself.
This is a big one. It comes from painstakingly reconstructing a very old skull found in China, known as Yangtze II. It was badly crushed over time.
How old is it?
Really ancient, somewhere between 940,000 and 1.1 million years old. After they digitally rebuilt it, the researchers concluded it looks like an early Denisovan, one of our mysterious ancient cousins.
Okay, an early Denisovan that old. What does that do to the timeline of human evolution?
It throws a huge wrench in it. The implication is radical. It pushes the date for ancestor X, the common ancestor we share with Neanderthals and Denisovans, back to over 1 million years ago. That's more than twice as old as current genetic estimates suggest.
Wow. And the specific family tree they propose is controversial, too.
It is. Their analysis suggests Neanderthals split off first, maybe 1.38 million years ago. That would make Denisovans our closest ancient relatives, splitting off later. That flips some previous ideas on their head. But we should say, many geneticists working with ancient DNA are skeptical of these neat branching trees. They often prefer a more tangled network model with lots of interbreeding and regional splits happening.
But whichever way the branches go, pushing that initial split back over 1 million years leaves some big gaps in the fossil record, right?
Huge gaps. If our Homo sapiens lines split off that long ago, where are the million-year-old sapiens ancestors? We haven't found them. It also challenges the idea that ancestor X lived only in Africa. The Yangtze skull was found in China, suggesting maybe ancestor X lived somewhere like Western Asia, and our line spent most of the last 1 million years evolving in Africa before migrating out much later.
Lots of new questions.
Okay.
Shifting gears completely to the end of the dinosaur era, the Cretaceous, we have a new contender for the fiercest predator in its patch, found in Argentina, a megaraptor called Huachenraptor casali.
Yeah, this is a fantastic find, partly because of how it was preserved. They found its near-complete skull, and lodged right in its jaws was a bone, the humerus, or upper arm bone from an extinct relative of crocodiles.
Oh, and it died mid-meal.
Looks like it. Gives us this amazing little snapshot of behavior from 66 million years ago.
And what kind of threat was this thing?
It was pretty big, maybe 7 meters long, weighing at least a ton. Not T-Rex size, but formidable. Its main weapons were its arms, large and muscular, and especially its thumb claw, described as being the size of a human forearm, razor sharp, clearly built for tearing into large prey, definitely an apex predator in its environment.
Nasty. Okay, moving into conservation, and a really unique find from Saudi Arabia, mummified cheetahs.
Yes, 7 naturally mummified cheetahs found in the Logo Cave Network. They range in age from about 4,000 years old down to just 100 years old. And these are the first naturally mummified big cats ever discovered anywhere.
How did they get mummified?
The cage conditions were just perfect. Constant temperature, incredibly low humidity. It preserved not just bones, but skin, fur, soft tissues. A really rare window into the past.
But cheetahs aren't really known for living in caves, are they? Why were they there?
That's still a bit of a mystery, but the fact that several of the mummies were young cubs suggests maybe they used the caves occasionally as dens, perhaps for protection during very harsh weather conditions outside.
And this discovery has implications for cheetah conservation today.
It really does. Genetic analysis linked the older mummies to the cheetah subspecies currently found in Northwest Africa. This is crucial evidence showing that cheetahs historically could adapt and survive in quite arid, desert-like environments.
So it supports reintroduction efforts.
Exactly. It gives conservationists confidence that reintroducing African subspecies into suitable dry habitats could work because the species has proven resilient to those conditions in the past. It's historical data informing future strategy.
And just a quick positive note on conservation. The first Socorro dove chick has hatched at Whipsnade Zoo. That species has been extinct in the wild since 1972.
That's wonderful news. Every successful hatching in these kinds of international breeding programs is a vital step. It keeps the genetic line going and holds out hope for eventual reintroduction back into the wild.
Absolutely. Okay, speaking of survival challenges, let's transition now to maybe the biggest one we face, the climate crisis, and some potential solutions, starting with maybe cracking one of the toughest nuts in industrial emissions, cement.
Yeah, cement production is a monster for CO2. Accounts for something like 8% of global emissions. And the tricky part is, unlike, say, a power plant where you can switch fuel, a lot of the CO2 comes from the basic chemistry itself, heating limestone to make clinker, the main ingredient. That process releases CO2 no matter how you heat it.
So carbon capture and storage, CCS, is pretty much the only option right now on a large scale. Are we actually seeing it work commercially?
We are starting to, and that's the good news here. There are real-world projects coming online. Norway's Brevik cement plant is already capturing half its emissions and pumping the CO2 deep under the seabed for storage.
Okay.
And there's a new plant planned in the UK, Padeswood, aiming even higher. They want to capture 95% of their CO2 by 2029.
But the cost is still a huge hurdle, right?
It is. The estimates right now are somewhere between 50 and 200 euros to capture and store just 1 ton of CO2. Experts are clear. These projects only work initially with significant government subsidies.
Is there hope the cost will come down?
There is. New technologies are being developed, like something called oxyfuel combustion. Basically, you burn the fuel in pure oxygen instead of air, which makes the exhaust gas almost pure CO2, much easier and cheaper to capture. The hope is that tech like this will make CCS much more economical in the coming decade.
Okay, shifting from industry to ecosystems. A surprising finding from the Amazon rainforest.
Yeah.
All that extra CO2 in the atmosphere seems to be acting like fertilizer, making the trees bigger.
Yeah, this was a long-term study using satellite data and ground checks. It confirms that rising CO2 levels do boost photosynthesis, and the result. The average tree diameter across the Amazon has increased by about 3.3% per decade. The whole forest structure is shifting more big trees, fewer small ones.
Bigger trees sound good, right? They store more carbon. But there's a catch.
There's a big catch. Those larger, older trees are disproportionately important. They hold the vast majority of the carbon stored in the forest. But they are also the most vulnerable to climate change impacts like severe droughts or high winds.
Ah, so if we lose those big trees.
It's a huge risk. If more extreme weather takes out these carbon-rich giants, it could trigger a massive feedback loop, releasing enormous amounts of stored carbon back into the atmosphere, accelerating warming even further.
A worrying dynamic. And speaking of worrying dynamics, let's go to the other end of the Earth, Antarctica. There's news of serious atmospheric chaos happening there right now.
Yeah, really dramatic changes. Since early September, temperatures way up in the stratosphere above Antarctica have soared by over 35 degrees Celsius. That's a huge jump, and wind speeds up there have been cut in half.
What's causing that?
It's called a sudden stratospheric warming event, or SSW. Technically, these extreme upheavals should only happen maybe once every couple of decades, but we saw them in 2002, 2019, and now again in 2024. That increasing frequency is what has scientists really worried. It suggests fundamental shifts are happening.
And this chaos high above Antarctica doesn't just stay there, does it? It affects weather further north.
Absolutely. It disrupts atmospheric patterns across the entire southern hemisphere. The prediction is for strange weather, potentially including warmer, drier conditions and stronger westerly winds over places like Australia in the coming months.
And they think it's linked to warmer oceans.
It seems connected to a significant jump, 1 to 2 degrees Celsius, in sea surface temperatures in parts of the Pacific. The big worry isn't just the single SSW event, but the feeling that different changes in Antarctica, the sea ice loss, the heat waves on the continent, these atmospheric events are starting to link up and reinforce each other, creating feedback loops that could accelerate change faster than models predict.
Okay, let's end this section on a more positive note. A potential solution to the plastics trilemma. How to make plastic that's strong, tough, and easy to work with, all at the same time.
Right, that's been a huge challenge in material science. Usually, if you make a plastic stronger, it gets brittle, it breaks easily, so it's not tough. If you manage to make it strong and tough, it often becomes really thick and hard to mold or process industrially.
So what's the breakthrough ingredient?
Nanoparticles. Specifically, polystyrene nanoparticles. Researchers just mixed tiny amounts of these into common plastics like PEMA and PVC, and the results were pretty dramatic. PEMA, for example, became 50% stronger, but without losing its toughness.
How do the nanoparticles do that? How do they make it strong and tough?
Computer simulations showed something cool. The nanoparticles don't just sit there. When the plastic is stressed, they actually move around and redistribute themselves. This allows the material as a whole to deform more smoothly, absorbing energy instead of just snapping.
And crucially, this works with existing manufacturing.
That's the key. It's compatible with current industrial processes. So this could be rolled out relatively quickly to make better, lighter materials for everything from airplanes and cars to more sustainable packaging. A really neat piece of materials engineering.
That is encouraging. Okay, let's make one final shift now. To culture, maybe consciousness, and some of the deepest mysteries about the universe itself. We heard about cement factories. Apparently, physics has beauty factories.
Yes, they do. These are particle accelerators, facilities that collide electrons and their antimatter counterparts, positrons, at high energy. Their specific purpose is to create lots of particles called beamesons. These contain a beauty antiquark.
And why are these beautiful particles so important?
Because they might hold the keys to solving two of the absolute biggest puzzles in cosmology.
Okay, puzzle number one.
Matter versus antimatter. The biggest mystery of all, really. Why is the universe full of stuff instead of being empty? The Big Bang should have created equal amounts of matter and antimatter, which would have just annihilated each other, leaving only light.
So how do beamesons help?
Neutral beamesons do this weird thing. They spontaneously flip back and forth between being a matter particle, meson, and an antimatter particle, antimeson, if there's even a tiny asymmetry in how long they spend in each state. Say they exist fractionally longer as matter. That tiny imbalance, multiplied over trillions of particles in the early universe, could be enough to explain why matter won out and we're here.
Wow. Okay, what's the second big mystery they tackle?
Dark matter. These beauty factories are perfectly designed to produce beamesons and then watch them decay, carefully tracking all the particles produced. This makes them ideal hunting grounds for a hypothetical mediator particle, something that could link the visible matter we know with the invisible dark matter.
Like a bridge particle.
Exactly. They're sifting through mountains of old data, even from experiments like BABAR that shut down years ago, looking for tiny anomalies in beamesin decays that might signal the fleeting existence of such a particle, maybe something like an axion acting as that bridge.
Fascinating. Okay, next, a look back at what one opinion piece calls a major historical mistake, the way psychedelic science was shut down in the 1970s.
Yeah, the piece argues that the political backlash, the whole war on drugs, was basically a giant self-inflicted wound on science. It effectively slammed the door on decades of really promising research into using psychedelics therapeutically.
And not just for things like depression or PTSD, which we hear about now.
No, the early research was much broader. They were looking at potential uses for addiction, chronic pain, even helping recovery after strokes or potentially slowing dementia. All that research just stopped pretty much overnight.
And the piece sees it as a warning for today.
Definitely. While research is thankfully booming again now, the story is a cautionary tale about letting politics or ideology block scientific discovery. And there's a modern twist. The article raises concerns about the huge influx of big business and venture capital into psychedelic research now.
A worry about profit motives.
Yeah, the concern is that commercial interests could potentially influence which treatments get developed or how accessible they are, maybe prioritizing profit over the widest possible benefit. It's a reminder to keep the science first.
That tension between human decision-making and maybe more primal drives is explored in a book review featured this week, Warhead, by Nicholas Wright.
writes a neuroscientist, and his argument is that conflict itself has actually shaped human evolution. Our brains influence how we fight, but warfare has also influenced how our brains evolved. He uses historical battles as case studies.
What's the core neuroscience idea he explores?
He talks about how our brains constantly build these models of the world, our internal sense of reality based on experience and culture. In conflict, under stress, our primal responses kick in. And when reality clashes sharply with our mental model, we get prediction errors.
And those errors mess with our decisions.
Massively, especially in high-stakes situations. These errors tax our ability to assess risk, feel empathy, maintain self-control. It can lead to disastrous escalation, but sometimes understanding these mechanisms can also lead to surprising moments of de-escalation or restraint. It's about understanding the brain's biases under pressure.
Very relevant.
Yeah.
Okay, let's wrap up with a couple of quick interesting hits before our final thought. First, apparently scientists have been ignoring mouse squeaks.
Huh. Yeah, it sounds funny, but it's a serious point. For decades, researchers studying mouse behavior have focused almost entirely on their high-frequency ultrasonic calls, the ones we can't hear.
Right.
But mice also make audible squeaks, and researchers are now arguing these squeaks, which change in pitch and intensity depending on the social situation, have been almost completely overlooked. They think these ignored squeaks hold untapped potential for understanding communication, social status, things like that. A classic case of maybe missing the obvious.
Amazing. And finally, something for sky watchers. We're in for a treat with 4 supermoons in a row.
That's right. Starting this October and running through January, a supermoon happens when the full moon lines up with its perigee, the closest point in its orbit to Earth.
So it looks bigger and brighter.
Yep. Up to about 8% bigger and 15% brighter than an average full moon. The best time to see the effect is usually when the moon is rising or setting near the horizon. Atmospheric effects create an optical illusion then that makes it seem even more enormous. Worth looking out for.
Definitely. Well, we have covered an incredible amount of ground today, from pushing back the roots of human evolution by maybe 500,000 years.
To finding new physics that suggests time itself might not be absolute, and seeing real hope for slowing down devastating brain diseases.
What really stands out, weaving through it all, is that theme we touched on, the gap between structure and function. We talked about the worm brain map, knowing all the connections didn't explain the how.
Exactly. And it's the same looking outwards at black holes. We can map the shadow, the structure, but we still don't truly know what's inside. Is it a singularity, a fuzzball, a gravistar?
So if mapping the roads doesn't tell us where the traffic flows, here's the final thought for you, our listener. What kind of revolutionary new tools or approaches do we need? Not just to map the static components of reality, whether it's quantum fields or neurons or even political systems, but to truly understand the dynamic processes, the flow of time, the emergence of consciousness, the drivers of conflict and cooperation.
That's the frontier, isn't it? Moving beyond just mapping to understanding the actual dynamics. It probably requires entirely new ways of thinking and maybe entirely new kinds of scientific probes.
Something to ponder. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.